This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, the story of a man who sampled his microbiome every day for a year and kept a diary. But first, if you're a Seinfeld fan, chances are you've seen this memorable episode where Elaine happens to catch a glimpse of her medical record and then hatches a plot with Kramer to steal the chart from the doctor's office. Remember that? So that she can read everything that's been scribbled on it.
Get in there, get the chart, and get out. You got it?
Yeah, no problem. One chart coming up.
Okay. Where's my chart? Did you get it?
No.
What? What happened?
I don't know, but now they got a chart on me.
Well, in real life, thankfully, you don't need to steal your chart, but it can be a challenge. Some doctors make you fill out a form, then fax it or mail it or hand deliver it to the office just to request your own record. And they may not give it to you digitally either. Other times, though, it can be as easy as logging into a patient portal and downloading your records onto your device. You want to give it a try? We're going to give you some hints on how to do that. Here to talk about your rights and how you can get your records onto that health app on your phone and some of the innovations underway aimed at getting your digital records to you are Christina Farr, senior writer at Fast Company in San Francisco. She joins us from the TEDMed conference in Palm Springs. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me. This is one of my favorite topics.
Well, thank you. Erin Mackay is coordinator of Get My Health Data, an initiative that advocates for patient access to digital health records in Washington. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks very much, Ira. I'm excited to chat with you.
Well, it's good to have you, too. Christina, you wrote a story about the CEO of a health IT company whose own wife had a terrible time getting her own medical records and sort of changed things for him.
Yes, that was a fascinating story to write because this is someone who, you know, is the CEO of one of the largest health IT companies in America. And when his wife got sick, you know, I guess everyone becomes a patient at some point. She had to carry around her medical information in paper bags. And I had a very honest conversation with him last year when I wrote the story, and he was really taking a look and saying, you know, what more could I be doing to fix this situation, to make sure that all patients have easy access to their medical information and that it's digitized.
Mm-hmm. And Erin Mackay, for most people, is it that much of a hassle? How far have we come from that Seinfeld episode?
Well, that Seinfeld episode actually aired the year that HIPAA took effect, and particularly the law that gave patients access to their health information. But unfortunately, it still continues to be quite difficult for patients to navigate the records request process, and particularly to obtain, as you say, digital copies of their health information. I think there's a lack of understanding of the rights patients have to this information and providers' responsibilities to make it available. And so that is what Get My Health Data, an initiative of the National Partnership for Women and Families, has been looking into for the last year. You know, what is it like for people on the ground to request their medical records, and what barriers do they often encounter?
Mm-hmm. I encountered one barrier when I wanted an x-ray from my doctor, and he gave me a little disc, and I brought it home, and I couldn't read it. I didn't have a format translator for it.
Yeah, unfortunately, most laptops and computers these days aren't sold with disk drives, and that is one of the ways that digital copies are often made available, burned onto a drive or perhaps in a PDF. And while that's a great start in terms of getting electronic data to patients, it's not available in the sort of structured file format that
right.
would make it possible to upload into a health app of a patient's choice, for example, to make it easier to organize data and compile data from different doctors and hospital settings, because many patients have their data sort of strewn about different institutions, and it would be great to give them a complete consolidated view of their health history.
Christina, are big tech companies like Apple and Google working to make this easier for patients?
Yes, and that's been one of the sort of big areas of optimism in the past 5 years or so, is companies like Apple, which you wouldn't really associate with healthcare, even a few years ago, have made a big push into trying to get this medical information to patients. They've released things like HealthKit, which is one of their sort of interfaces that aims to bring together the medical information that you might get from a provider, like, you know, your lab history and so on, and combine that with the types of information that patients are now collecting themselves. So if you have an accelerometer on your iPhone, or maybe you're collecting your blood pressure or heart rate, all that information can now be combined together on a smartphone. But of course, the challenge remains, you know, much of this information, as has already been discussed, it's just not machine readable. It can't be read by a computer. And that continues to be a major source of frustration.
Mm-hmm. Are there small startups that know this and see that there's money to be made by getting an app that will read all these different things that you can download into it?
Absolutely. I actually tried one recently called Picnic Health. You pay them a fee, and they will go out and try to get all of your medical records from all of the different hospitals and health systems that you've ever been to throughout your life. So that doesn't mean it's going to be perfectly aggregated information, because they still might claim that, you know, they've lost your record or they can't find it. But it's just on one level, it's like great that these startups exist. On another level, it's this information, we have the right to have it. Like, you shouldn't have to pay someone else to go out and find it for you. But you know, we're still at that point, and we certainly haven't reached this holy grail of true interoperability or data sharing yet.
Well, let me ask both of you this general question: that do you have a right? Should your doctor, is he or she forced to give you your records if you demand them?
Absolutely. Patients unequivocally have a right to a copy of their medical record and other health data, and that now includes a digital copy of that information if the doctor has the capability to produce it electronically. So, you know, patients aren't necessarily asking their doctor for a favor for copies of these medical records. They should, you know, they're no longer difficult patients as in the Seinfeld episode. They are simply asking for what they have a right to. And also I would note that, you know, empowering patients with this kind of information to help them make decisions, to set and track goals, to share information, as Christina says, that they have about their health status and their symptoms is particularly important.
I've had doctors tell me, you know, I think it's a great idea to share information, but I'm fearful of putting your records out on the internet.
Yeah, I've heard that too. And, you know, there was a great program a number of years ago called Open Notes, which is still ongoing. This idea that we should be sharing clinicians' notes with patients, or maybe you can even find out if you are a difficult patient or if there's something wrong in your medical record. And one of the fears that I heard from doctors early on around that is, you know, how is a patient going to react if they read that I've written that they're obese? Or they might confuse a medical term like SOB. And, you know, once the pilot and the trial was rolled out, it turned out that was really, a rare occurrence, if at all. Like, patients seemed to really be very receptive to this kind of information, and they didn't see much pushback around it.
So Aaron, what should a patient do? Let's say you're starting from zero, you know, and you want to get your medical records. What steps should I or anybody take?
I think first and most important, it's important to have an understanding of what your rights are. And we offer a lot of tools and resources on getmyhealthdata.org to help you understand what your rights to your medical records are, how to navigate the request process, and then I think very importantly, what to do once you get that data. I think that's another important piece is once you understand your rights, once you make the request and hopefully successfully receive your data, you know, you need to be thinking about a safe and secure place to store it. There are a lot of apps on the market that either will go out and make the request for you or provide a place for you to store and organize your data. But there's a lot of variation in how apps or medical devices use, share, and protect health information. And so I think it's important that we start doing a better job telling patients about these, you know, apps, data sharing policies and practices in a transparent and understandable way so that consumers can make these decisions and feel confident that they have easy and secure access to their data when they need it.
Well, let's talk about that a bit, Christina. I mean, there are people, I'm sure, who are going to feel insecure that hackers are going to go get my information and either sell it to someone else or hold it for ransom or blackmail me or whatever.
Yeah, and this is a serious consideration. I was recently invited by IBM's security team to take a tour of the dark web. You know, which is a place that sort of hackers can go and do not very legal things in a lot of cases. And I saw a lot of medical records up for sale. These medical records are the new credit cards. So, you know, hospitals have not been rated particularly highly in the past for their security practices. And I think, you know, in the next 5 years, we're going to see increasing pressure for them to, you know, be as secure as, say, other industries that manage sensitive information, yeah, like the financial sector.
Well, that's what hackers have told me, that we don't have to hack into the hospital because it's so insecure within the hospital itself. It'll leak out.
Yeah, I mean, I've even heard of cases where, you know, some of this information gets faxed, it gets left there for a while, and anyone could just walk past and pick it up. And that's pretty scary that something like that could happen.
Erin, mm-hmm. Any idea if the whole healthcare technology space might change much under this new administration?
Well, I think the good news is there is a great amount of attention to the role that health data plays in, as I said previously, empowering consumers to take a greater role in their health and in their health care. And I think that's a goal that is agreed upon by both the old administration and the incoming administration. Luckily, the issue of health IT, health information technology, has long enjoyed bipartisan support. And recently, actually, just yesterday, the House of Representatives approved a sweeping medical innovation bill that included some provisions related to health data and interoperability, and particularly around increasing patient access to their data, to longitudinal records, so a more holistic, comprehensive, you know, view of your health information, and also in a computable format, which, as Christina mentioned, is really critical to making the data that we have more actionable and useful in both the daily lives of patients, but also for providers.
Yeah, and a good place to start might be at getmyhealthdata.com.
Absolutely. We would love for you to take advantage of our resources and request your medical records and share your experience so that we can work with the system overall to seek improvement.
Erin McKay, coordinator of Get My Health Data and initiative advocate for patient access. Also, Christina Farr, senior writer at Fast Company in San Francisco. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Have a great weekend. We're going to take a break, and coming up, ever looked at the dead squirrel and thought, gee, this is my next art project? We're going to talk about taxidermy, the stuff of museums, get it, and something you can do at home. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. When was the first time you saw those stuffed animals in the Natural History Museum, posed carefully in museum dioramas all over the country? Lions stalk prey. Antelopes, grays, hawks court mates, and deceased animals of all kinds find new life. But taxidermy is not just the stuff of museums or deer hunters with animal heads above the fireplace. In the last decade, taxidermy as a hobby has risen in popularity, and for some, it's an art form, like this three-headed bird that is sitting in front of me right now on a two-headed animal skull. Rogue taxidermy, it has been called. And as my guest will tell you, reanimating the dead takes both an artistic sensibility and a keen eye for anatomy. And you can even try this yourself. There are do-it-yourself kits. We're going to talk all about it. I have two taxidermists with me today. Tim Bovard has been a taxidermist since the 1980s for the Natural History Museum in Los Angeles, and is one of the few full-time museum taxidermists left in the U.S. Welcome to Science Friday.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
You're welcome. Anantharaman.
I got it.
Thank you. A taxidermy artist based in New York. She teaches workshops and is co-author of the new Do-It-Yourself Guide to Taxidermy, Stuffed Animals, a Modern Guide to Taxidermy. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. I'm happy to be here.
Let me talk about this object in front of me. Describe what we're looking at.
All right. So this is a piece. It's made with a European starling. It's made with three of them and two coyote skulls. And it's, you know, the skulls are put together to look polycephalic. The birds are put together to also look polycephalic. And it's, you know, it's a play on both mythology and scientific oddities.
And why did you do that?
A lot of times when I'm doing taxidermy, when I'm doing stuff for clients, I'll get lots of things that are not quite ideal for a traditional mount. They might not be, you know, they might be roadkill specimens. Mm-hmm. They might be specimens that are just not in the best shape. So this is sort of a way to give new life to them. And it also goes with the tradition of gaff making and sort of, you know, mythology, that sort of sci-fi area.
And Tom, you've been doing this for quite a while. Why was taxidermy the career for you, Tim?
Fascination with nature. From a very early age as a kid, my dad was a college professor, my mom didn't dissuade me from wanting to try and take, you know, something dead and make it look alive again. And you do have to have, if you're going to do it as a kid, of course, you have to have parents that are willing to let you play with things that you find, and the fascination has continued right up to today. Is, can I take that, you know, dead animal from, you know, a zoo, from a salvage situation, whatever it is, and make it look realistic or lifelike? And just like Divya, I don't always have ideal specimens. So, you know, but in this day and age, of course, I have to make the best of what we have to tell the kind of story we might want to tell here in a museum exhibit.
Did the museums used to actually go out and kill the animals to add to their collections? Has that changed?
Well, back for you know, many years, I would say that was a very common practice, because we also built our research collections that way. And museums across the country have, you know, the larger museums with big collections have a lot of material that they collected over years. In today, at least here, we don't collect that much because we regularly get stuff in from what we call a salvage situation. So that could be, we have a large marine mammal collection, and that comes in from National Marine Fisheries. That's whales that watch up on the beach, all that kind of stuff that comes in for our research collection. For birds, we have, you know, all kinds of sources there. They come into rehab centers, they're injured, they fly in the windows, whatever. Those can either become part of our research collection, or if I need them for a taxidermy exhibit, I can use them for that. Mm-hmm. So, but way back, I mean, prior to my being here at least, there were, I'd say, fairly regular trips out to collect material to support our diorama program. So this might be, it might not be just animal specimens. It might be rocks, it might be plant molds, everything to try and recreate, because when we're doing a diorama, we're trying to recreate an actual place.
Yeah.
So we need all the reference possible. But even back then, you know, rare animals, endangered
right.
animals, that wouldn't have been collected. Those would have come from some zoos if they were in captivity.
Divya, you didn't work for a museum. How did you get involved in this?
I got involved from, my mom was a biology teacher, and so from a young age, I've always loved, you know, art and science, and I've loved anything that combines the two, you know, because art and science are both ways of making sense of the world, and, you know, especially animals and anatomy, those have just been things I've been passionate about.
How easy is it for someone to get involved in this? In your book, Stuffed Animals, A Modern Guide to Taxidermy, it is a course, basically, right? It shows you how to do all these things.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I don't think it's safe to say taxidermy is easy. It's not something that you'll get an instant return on. It requires a lot of patience, and a lot of study, and it's a constant journey. You're always, you know, I'm always looking at, even if I'm making something fantasy-like, I'm always looking at reference. I'm always researching, you know, the habitat of the animal, or, like, you know, sort of trying to create that illusion of something being real. You know, you're always studying, but I do think that once you get the hang of it, the payoff is great. And, you know, it can also, doing it yourself, it can also serve as sort of like a citizen science too, you know, like taking something into your own hands. And a lot of times after classes, students will say that, you know, they've never looked at a bird that way before, or they've never, you know, they've never thought so much of a lowly mouse or a rat.
They start off with some rodents to begin with, and how do the students take it? They actually have to dissect it, right?
Well, you're skinning it, so you're not really dissecting it. We have to take out, you know, individual organs. You're taking the carcass out as one piece. So a lot of them say it's not any worse than, you know, preparing a turkey on Thanksgiving or something like that. It's a little more visceral because you see the animal's face, whereas with, you know, a turkey from the grocery store, we don't, you know, we're not face-to-face with it. But I've not had, you know, I think people know what they're getting into when they come to a class, and I've not had anyone, I've not had anyone have an extremely bad reaction or anything like that.
Tim Beaufort, when we say an animal is stuffed, is that an accurate thing to say? What's really going on?
Well, there is a technique by where you literally sort of stuff the skin. Generally, it's just done on smaller, very small mammals or birds to get end up with a realistic. That's if you're trying for a realistic mount. In most cases, though, for me at least, stuffed animals refers to like stuffed animal toys, okay, which really are stuffed with cotton.
Mm-hmm.
In most cases, for me, I'm making an armature or an artificial body that I'm going to glue and sew that skin to, and that's going to be pretty close to what the original animal looked like, ideally, before I put the skin on. So when I'm done, I end up with something that looks realistic.
You once made a polar bear, I understand, not from a bear, but from a very old bearskin rug?
That is correct.
What kind of challenge was that?
Polar bear that's in our Age of Mammals, because I didn't have. Once again, we have to go with what we have. And the only skin I had during that period of time when I needed to create a bear for that Age of Mammals exhibit was a 1960s polar bear rug. So that rug, and that rug was already degrading because of acid that's left in the skin from old tans and literally falling apart. And I took all those pieces and pieces from another falling apart bear and glued them onto that form to create that particular final, what I consider a more of a replica bear, because I did not start with a whole skin. It was just pieces. But our public seems to like it and accept it as a polar bear, so that's okay.
What goes on in the tanning process? Everybody's heard about it, but what is going on, you know, physically, chemically in that process?
Well, multiple steps, and there's all kinds of different kinds of tanning. So, you know, in general for taxidermy, the skin is salted first. That helps to take the natural moisture out of the skin and prevent it from rotting. And in my case here, I'll even do very small animals like mice or rats or squirrels or whatever. I'll tan those skins. So, and then after being salted, it's going to go into a pickle solution. And then after being in a pickle solution for a few days, or it might be a matter of a couple of weeks in the case of a bigger animal, in which case that skin is cleaned during that process, and in the case of a large animal, shaved down to a uniform thickness, it's finally put in a tanning bath overnight, then oiled with a tanning oil so that when you're done, you have this fairly durable, literally if you've turned it into a type of leather, and it so you're going to get usually less shrinkage than you would have if you were working with a raw skin, and it's usually less attractive to various pests. So that means insects, other things that might want to chew on that final product that you produce.
Divya, as someone who teaches classes, what are the most common mistakes the beginners are making?
Ooh, I think one of the most common mistakes is to overlook the study of reference, you know, to sort of try and rush into it and try and just like, you know, while we're carving our forms or while we're making the bodies in class, I think a lot of times, the biggest mistake is to just rush into it and not really closely look at the anatomy.
One of the chapters in your book talks about how we can use a beetles to clean the bones of animals,
right?
If you want to incorporate that. What kind of beetles are they, and you know. Is that something you do?
Yeah, so those are dermestid beetles. And I don't, because I'm in New York City, I don't have a colony of my own because I don't want them to be that close to my home and to my own to my personal collection. But I do have a friend who lives upstate that has lots of land, and she has beetles, the co-author of our book, actually. And so those beetles are, they're dermestid beetles. You know, they require their own care and maintenance, you know, keeping the right humidity, keeping them fed, feeding them what they, you know, feeding them what they like. Sometimes some colonies can be pickier than others.
We actually have a sample of how they sound. working on an owl carcass, a never-before-heard performance by the Beatles. Those are the Beatles, dude.
That's them.
Right here in our stage.
We use them here
That's
at the
great.
Museum as well.
Do you?
Yeah, we use them here to clean
the
skeletons.
I think the first time
well.
I heard about them was in the novel Gorky Park, an old, I think from the 60s. They talked about using beetles in a case in Russia. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking about dermatology with Divya Anantharaman and also Tim Bovard. It's fascinating. Is this Divya growing? Is this a growing hobby, a growing art form now?
I do think so. I mean, I think it's growing mainly because it's something that just can't be digitized. You know, you can't digitize human observation and, you know, creating something with your hands. I don't think, I don't think it will ever be turn to the digital, so I do think the interest is growing.
Yeah, I agree with Divya here. This is just really, it's really gotten more and more popular, and especially at least the fastest growing numbers that I see, and I think other people see this across the country, is women in growing in taxidermy. And you know, I sort of wonder if it definitely has to do with, this is a real thing, and dealing with something real, as opposed to most of our lives where, you know, you've got your smartphones and various video games and whatever that have almost nothing to do with reality. And, well, when you're looking at this dead animal, or you're working with this real skin or real part of an animal, a skull, it's the real thing.
You know,
and that's, of course, always the fascination with museums anyways.
Well, you know, speaking of the real thing, I've got to ask this question because it's sort of an obvious one, and people have been asking me about it. You know, there are these exhibits of the body where we see real bodies of people, of dead people. What, is it possible or desirable to do that? A stuffed human. Is anybody, you know, talked about that, or are there laws against it? Or
I think one of the only case I know of is Jeremy Bentham, who was in, I think that was the closest thing I've heard of human, like, taxidermy, where the skin, you know, where taxidermy means, like, mounting a skin onto a form. I think he was the only case I know of, and I think, I mean, oh, I forget which school it was, but it was a place in London around the 1800s, and that was his last will and testament. But the bodies exhibit and all of that, that's plastinated, so that's a process where the tissue is replaced with plastic.
Is there is there a term for taxidermy? You know, can you do you taxidermy something, or is it, what is the word?
I like to say mounted. I like to say mounted. Tim, what do you like?
Mounted skin over. The issue you have with any skin, the biggest challenge, I think, for a taxidermist in a lot of ways is that skin, when we're finally done with it, it's all dried out and really shriveled up. And so we have to do something to it to give the illusion that that's a plump skin, like, you know, and so primates, for instance, are difficult to do, meaning apes and monkeys and things like that have naked parts, because that can look, if you just use tan skin for that, unless you do some very specialized techniques or you replace that, it does not look like lifelike skin.
Yeah.
Okay, and so that, I think, is when you looked at the body, the body exhibits that were the plastinated
I've got to interrupt, Tim. We've run out of time. Tim Bovard, taxidermist at the Natural History Museum, Los Angeles, California. Divya Ananthuraman is a taxidermy artist in New York. And our thanks to KCRW's Here Be Monsters podcast episode. We pay them in meat for the Beatles. So, well, we're very happy to have them. We're going to take a break, and afterwards we're going to look in the ins and outs of the daily routine of our microbiome with a guy who sampled his microbiome every day for a year and wrote about it. He'll join us after the break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Almost every week there is some discovery about the microbiome. What do you imagine a day in the life of one of your gut bacteria might look like? Dear Diary, today woke up to the sound of the stomach grumble alarm, made it on time to roll call with the other actinobacteria, had to battle a few hostile clostridium to make it to my spot, had a hard time meeting my metabolite quota for the day, must have been that late high-fat burger bomb we received yesterday. There's whispers of a possible penicillin push. We'll wait and see. Well, time to hit the sack, the intestinal sack, that is. Of course, we have no idea what your microbiome might actually be thinking. But one researcher did keep daily diary of his microbiome. He tracked his own microbes for an entire year, sampling them every day. He's here to tell us what he learned from tracking his own bacteria. Lawrence David, assistant professor of molecular genetics and microbiology at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello.
So tell us, did you actually took samples every day of your microbiome and kept track of the bacteria in them?
That's right.
And I'm speechless. And you did it from your mouth and your gut, right? Two different places.
Yes, those are two of the easier places to get to.
And what was the hardest part of that process?
Well, there were at least two. One was, as you might expect, sampling your stool every day for a year. It took a little while for that to start becoming a normal habit and not feel too gross. And the second was, that was, I'd say, even harder, was one of the things we were interested in, and I'll say I was doing this actually with my my graduate advisor at the time. What we wanted to do was figure out not just how bacteria were changing over time, but figure out what parts of our daily lives might be affecting those dynamics. And so what we spent a lot of time and effort in doing was tracking how we were also just living our lives and where we were going, what we were eating, how we were feeling, and seeing if we could link that to the bacteria. But all of that tracking took a lot of time, actually a lot more time than I had initially expected. And so I'd say that was one of the harder parts.
Were you able to find a correlation between what you were doing, traveling, eating, going abroad? I understand you traveled out of the country. Did you notice changes?
Oh, sure, yeah. You know, I saw changes in just the gross abundances of different kinds of bacteria that were in my gut when I traveled abroad. But what was really interesting was that, you know, initially I had thought, well, I'd be going abroad and exposed to all kinds of new bacteria, and I'd end up with new kinds of microbes inside my gut. That wasn't really the case, and instead what it turned out happened was about, you know, if you look at the bacteria that I sampled in my gut while I was abroad, about 90% of them were already there before I left. And vice versa, most of the bacteria that I had with me before I left managed to hang around while I was overseas.
So you didn't really get any new ones coming in. You just the size of the ones inside of you just shrank and expanded.
That's exactly right. And, you know, that to me was one of the most interesting observations in this study, was that it looks like it's really hard to pick up new bacteria, that the ones that are inside of you at any given time really are going to persist for a while. And getting new ones in there, I think, is not easy.
Did you try to eat any probiotics, either in pill form or whatever, to see if you could change the bacteria in there?
Yeah, so when I look back over the course of the year, you know, one of the things that I tried to do, or a goal of this study, was not to change my, you know, regular lifestyle and just see what kind of normal variation or normal day-to-day life did to the microbiome. But so when I looked back, it turned out that occasionally I had I'd eat yogurt, and you could see those bacteria in stool samples that I collected maybe the day after I ate them, but they didn't really hang around actually much longer after that.
So that was very surprising to you, I imagine.
Oh yeah, of course. Although, you know, looking back, I think others had noticed that too when looking at how long bacteria that are found in fermented foods or dairy products mm-hmm. stay in the gut.
You had a collaborator who also collected his microbiome, and he got sick during the project. Did you see a pattern for why he got sick?
Yeah, so that was, I'd say, one of the other really surprising and notable observations in our study. What happened was in this subject, he got salmonella. And what ended up happening is that in that week that he was ill, about half the bacteria that were present in his intestine, it looked like in a pretty stable way for months before that illness, about half those bacteria just sort of dropped out and fell to about the detection limit for our methods for identifying bacteria. And they stayed down there for the remaining, I'd say, 3 months that we were observing him. So that, to me, spoke to potentially things like illness or infection potentially having a really profound impact on bacteria in the gut.
I want to bring on another guest because our gut bacteria, as we're learning, has an order. Our microbes have a circadian rhythm. Our body's clock, you know, that keeps things internally on schedule, has that rhythm. But it turns out the microbiome has its own circadian rhythm, too. In research published this week in the journal Cell, scientists looked at this clock inside of our gut. And here to tell us why that is important and what they found is Aaron Elinov. He's an author on that paper. He's also a senior researcher at the Department of Immunology at the Weizmann Institute of Science in Rehovot, Israel. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi there.
Dr. Elinov, you had a study out a few years ago that saw our circadian rhythm can affect microbiomes. And this recent paper was a mouse study. And you saw that it's a two-way street, that the microbiome has its own clock.
Absolutely. The scientific community has realized in the last few years that we have millions of different clocks in our body. Actually, we have a clock in every one of our cells in our body, and in a very interesting and fascinating way, they are coordinated in their functions. And since we regard our gut microbes as an integral part of our body, we wanted to test whether they too have a circadian activity. So we measured them at different times of the day using many different techniques, and we were amazed to find that our gut microbes in many different aspects behave differently at different times of the day.
Do they sync up with the other clocks in our body, or are they on their own clock?
Yeah, so they are actually very well coordinated with our own, our human or our mouse host circadian clocks. And in fact, what we were amazed to see that the two clocks behave like, if you may, like a tango, in which they greatly influence one another. For example, if we disrupt the microbes, our host clock goes crazy, and hundreds of different genes either lose or gain a circadian activity that was not present before.
Were you surprised by this?
We were highly surprised. The microbiome field is a very young field, and there's gathering information that points to the possibility that, in fact, our human body or our human machine is a compound machine that is composed of the host part and the microbial part. But this behavior, which is so well coordinated, just gave us a classical example that basically confirms this observation. So if we disturb one of the partners, the other partner is very dramatically affected.
Yeah, well, I wanted to ask about that. If it loses the synchronization, if the microbiome starts losing that synchronization, what happens to the body?
So we've tested in this study, we've tested this effect in two different body sites. The first one was the gastrointestinal tract itself, which is located just where the microbes were. And there we saw that if we disrupt the microbes, for example, by administering a wide spectrum antibiotics, immediately the normal circadian rhythm of the host gastrointestinal cells goes completely disrupted and changes its behavior to a very new behavior. But what was even more fascinating for us occurred when we tested the liver, which is located, if you may, miles away from where the gut microbes live. And when we tested the liver circadian rhythmicity, we saw that it too was greatly affected by the clock activity of the microbes. So if we disrupted the gut microbes by killing them by antibiotics, or by even performing a study in mice that do not have any gut microbes of themselves, these are sterile germ-free mice, the liver circadian rhythmicity was very dramatically changing as well.
And so do we disrupt them? Do we unknowingly in our daily lives by what we do and we eat and things like that? Do we disrupt the cycle of our microbiome and possibly cause ill effects on our bodies?
Absolutely. So you know, an integral part of modern life involves many unintentional interventions that potentially could disturb the normal rhythmicity of our microbes. In our studies, both in mice and in humans, we induced a severe state of, a jet lag or a state that imitates a shift work in which the day and night cycles are disrupted over a long period of time. And one of the first and most pronounced changes that we saw was a change in this normal microbial rhythmic activity, and this resulted in a change of the microbe towards a configuration that predisposed both the mice or the humans to develop obesity, diabetes, and their complications. And actually, if you look in the medical literature, and now I'm talking as a physician, for the past 50 or 70 years, there has been a lot of literature pointing towards a possible connection between chronic disruption of normal sleep-wake cycles, such as in shift workers, and the propensity to develop obesity and diabetes. And our study suggests that at least one potential important, previously unknown explanation for this association lies in the normal cyclic behavior of our microbes, which is so easily disturbed when we disrupt our daily routines.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Dr. Aaron Elinov and Dr. Lawrence David about our microbiome. Dr. David, did you notice in collecting your own samples at different times of day, different microbiome?
No, I didn't. You know, and one of the really interesting things that really impresses me about Dr. Elinov's work is that it didn't really occur to us to actually look at changes in within a single day. You know, we were taking advantage of just sort of natural human circadian rhythms, and our, you know, myself and my collaborator didn't really tend to produce stool more than once a day. And so I think that's the real power and really exciting thing about, again, what Dr. Elinov is doing is showing that within a single day, we see these kinds of dynamics.
Yeah. You know, what's also interesting, there doesn't seem to be a day that goes by or a week that goes by without a continuing stream of new research about the microbiome. There was even research out this week about in mice the gut microbiome affecting possibly Parkinson's disease. Are you as amazed as I am as I read about all these, Dr. Elinov, about all these new things we're learning?
Yeah, we are quite amazed and fascinating by the amount of new data. We need to remember that we're talking about a field that was just reborn just 8 or 9 years ago, following the technological breakthroughs that were part of the Human Genome Project. So this is a very young field, but in a very short period of time, we discovered that we have a second genome, which is 150-fold larger than our human genome, is and lives right within us throughout our life. So of course, it is not surprising that this affects our physiology or our tendency to develop disease in very fascinating new ways that we haven't imagined before.
Dr. David, where do you go now? Are you going to continue with your diary collecting, or do you modify it, or what would you do next?
Oh, no, not at all. And in fact, I've totally stopped doing that kind of diary collection. You know, one of the things that, one of the other impetuses for this project was to get a sense for, engineers call this eating your own dog food, as a meaning that as someone designing these studies, what could we ask subjects and participants to do reasonably that wouldn't be too onerous? And, you know, one of the things that I took away from this is that it's a lot of work to track a lot of different variables in one's life and try and connect them to the microbiome. So, you know, what we've done since then is focus in on specific components of daily life. And one of the things that we've looked at in the past are things like just changing diet. And, you know, speaking to your earlier question, we have seen that a big change in diet within a single day can change the microbiome. And something else that we've been looking at now are probiotics and trying to figure out, well, how could we design them better so that they do persist longer in the gut?
Hmm. And what is our microbiome like to eat? What makes it healthy?
It eats both some of the different kinds of sugars that come in from the plant matter that we eat, but it also actually... we feed it as well. And, you know, I think this Dr. Elinov's work speaks to this too, how our bodies actually also secrete different kinds of sugars that feed the bacteria inside of us.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of diet, Dr. Elinov, should we eat to make our microbiome healthy?
Well, it's a billion-dollar question, and actually in one of our other works performed in over 1,000 human individuals, we actually discovered that there is not one good or bad diet for all individuals, and actually diet, just like our microbiome, is very individualized, and we actually offered some new ways to collect a lot of data from each individual and to design diets that are personally good for that individual.
This is great stuff. We have a lot more to talk about in the future. I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Dr. Aaron Elinov, Senior Researcher at the Department of Immunology at the Weizmann Institute of Science in Rehovot, Israel. Lawrence David, Assistant Professor of Molecular Genetics and Microbiology at Duke University. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today. One last thing before we go, calling all teachers. Applications for our 2017 Science Friday Educator Collaborative. Well, it's now alive. We'll work with you to develop free classroom resources for educators nationwide. You can apply now at sciencefriday.com/educator. That's sciencefriday.com/educator. 2017 Science Friday Educator Collaborative is now alive. BJ Lederman composed our theme music, and our thanks, as always, to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.